Welcome to Subcreation, the podcast that seeks and finds the divine in art, story, even muscle cars, and everything in between. Hello, glad to be with you again. Thank you for joining me in this next installment of Subcreation. Today I want to look at the story Snow White. Now, in this case, I am looking at the Disney version of Snow White, which came out in the late 30s, 1938, 39, something like that. First animated full-length feature film, won all these academies, put Walt Disney on the map, was the beginning of his fortune. I want to look at this because, for one reason, Tolkien didn't like Disney. And I don't think that was quite fair or right. He felt like Disney was an opportunist who was simply trying to make money off of these legitimate folk stories, and that Disney would rewrite them just to merchandise them. Now, that is true, that happened, but that wasn't Walt's doing. His brother Roy was the one who was the business mind behind the operation, and Roy would be the first one to tell you Walt had no clue about money. So I don't think that's a true fair characterization, even though I hate to ever disagree with Tolkien. I think Disney was up to something more with what he was trying to do, especially with this, his first full-length feature animated film. Say that three times fast. Snow White. So we're going to look at this today because there's some real interesting sophistication that is going on here that I think the critics miss. So many of the modern critics look at this and they say, well, it's a typical tale of Walt's own a poor portrayal of women, that they're weak, the damsel in distress, and they always need help. And, the modern tastes, the modern sensibilities just reject that portrayal. I understand that portrayal. I don't think that's what he's up to. I think he's up to something much more subtle and, as I said, something much more sophisticated. So let's jump in. So when this movie came out, it was so unique. Why would you make an animated feature? He didn't want to call it a cartoon because it was aimed at children, wasn't it? No, it was aimed at children, but it was aimed at adults as well. And so this was one of the first movies in color that people would go back and see again with their children. It did make him a fortune. It did open the doors for merchandising, but that's not what he was after. He was teaching his animators to use this medium of animated filmmaking, these feature-length films, to take their artistry to a new level. They're very perceptive. The expressions that they give their characters, the way they bring their characters to life, the 3D depth that they provided along with the coloration. And you're not just seeing the same background over and over again as the character is moving. You're seeing different background scenery changes and use of light and darkness and shimmering of water and capturing the kinds of expressions that before them you just didn't see in animated film. So this was really something unique. It was an achievement, and this is why it won so many Oscars and Academy Awards and received such fanfare. I think what's going on in this film, though, is something deeper than just Walt wanting to capitalize on a folktale. He is showing us something about femininity. Femininity versus a false understanding of femininity, which is represented by the Wicked Queen. We'll look at her. But I also see that he's juxtaposing the kind of femininity that we could call innocent, a femininity that didn't know evil, that hadn't experienced it fully. So there was an ignorance there that wasn't necessarily a weakness. However, there is a weakness that does come out in Snow White, and that's her naivete, her willingness to trust evil when she shouldn't. It's one thing to be ignorant of it, that's okay. I want to be ignorant of lots of evils. I don't want to know what suicide feels like or being addicted to serious drugs or hitting someone over the head with a lead pipe. I don't want to know what those things feel like. I don't want to experience those. I'm fine being ignorant of those. But there's something further problematic about naivete, where you don't understand that evil is something that cannot be trusted, that you don't want to try to make friends with it. And this is the weakness that we see that comes out in Snow White, but we see how this weakness is tied to a deeper and richer strength. All right, so let's look at this. I want to start with the queen, the wicked stepmother. Now notice, she's Snow White's stepmother. Now, Walt is not trying to say that all step-relatives, step-parents with step-children are like this, but we do know that in real life, many times, sadly, it is like this, where the step-parent doesn't have the same love and filial relationship with the child has with their real mother or their real father, their biological mother or father. So he throws in this dimension to show that they're living in the same household, but there's a sense of rivalry. And so this wicked queen, the stepmother, she's not enamored with Snow White, but she doesn't yet realize how attractive Snow White is. Every day she goes to this mirror, and this mirror represents her own self, sense of vanity, her desire for affirmation, which is not a bad thing, so long as we know how to seek it. And we're not seeking it as an end in and of itself for ourselves alone. Unfortunately, that is what she seeks. Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest one of all? Now, I have to admit, the fact that the mirror ever told her she was the fairest one of all is kind of a mystery. But she is beautiful, and because it's a reflection of her, it shows that for most of her time as the wicked queen, she did think that it was all about her. She did think she was the fairest one, until the day comes when she starts to notice Snow White, her stepdaughter, who's starting to come into her own. And now things change, as the mirror is not giving her the answer that she wants. And her vanity, she's beginning to feel insecure. She sees a threat from Snow White. Now, why would she feel threatened? She's the queen, she's powerful. We see that she knows magic. We see that she's older. And as the queen, Snow White is just the princess. The king is apparently dead, or at least he's nowhere to be found. So why would she be so insecure? So now we're beginning to see something come out of the queen with regard to her femininity and how she views Snow White. So with the queen, we are seeing something that's getting to be dangerous. There's something out of order here. There's an imbalance regarding her own desire for power. We see that in a true balanced realm, you're going to have some chaotic forces, meaning some unpredictability, some creativity, some things that are out of the ordinary. That can be good, particularly with creative geniuses like Walt Disney. But then we need to balance that with harmony and order. That provides beauty, and that's where the imbalance lies. She doesn't have that. She's in love with power, but she's recognizing there's a threat. So you see, there's something vulnerable that Snow White is exposing in this powerful queen who knows magic, who is a queen, who lives in the castle, who has a magic mirror. But we also see in the queen that she's very lonely. There's nobody who really hangs out with her. She has no relationship. When she's talking to the mirror, she's really talking to herself. Most of her dialogue is just self-directed. And if there are other creatures near her, like vultures or rats who tend to scurry from her, they're only there as a prop. There's no real connectivity and friendship or relationship. So whatever she is, this imbalance has made her antisocial and unable to trust goodness itself. In fact, goodness itself is why she feels threatened by Snow White. So this is an interesting insight. Remember, we're talking about Tolkien's definition of sub-creation being things that humans create, stories, art, music, muscle cars, whatever, that reveal us something about how the world works, showing us the irony, the paradox, the mystery of world, things that we otherwise would miss. But because it comes out in story, we pick up on it, it's more exciting, more entertaining. And then we have those aha moments where we can take from that experience of that film, in this case Snow White, and look at the world and go, okay, I'm starting to make sense out of things that are happening in my own world, my own life. Maybe it's people I know, maybe it's events that are happening in the world that I'm struggling to make sense out of, now this film is bringing wisdom to light. That's Tolkien's whole point of the difference between a piece of art that's sub-created, meaning it follows the pattern of primary creation that comes from God, versus something that becomes more manipulated, something more arbitrary, something that seems to reject something essential about creation, and thus it becomes absurd or weird or whatever. All right, so we're seeing that this fits into this mold of sub-creation. With femininity, one of the strong characteristics of femininity is woman's ability to receive. Not only to receive, but out of that receptivity, there's a strength, an ability to lead. With the queen, she seems to lack this ability. All she wants to receive is compliments that flatter her vanity, which is very superficial. She's unwilling to go deep. As I said, she doesn't trust goodness. We'll see as we look at Snow White, she's very receptive. She can take life on its own terms, albeit she's a bit naive. This is why she can encounter the animals or the woodland creatures who are not threatened by her. In fact, they are attracted to her and want to protect her. She can encounter the seven dwarves who likewise love her, and their names describe some qualities, some characteristics about them. And she can receive that and appreciate that without needing to manipulate it for her own ends. So again, we're beginning to see a contrast of femininity. So let's look at Snow White. So she's called Snow White because that's supposed to highlight her virtue, her feminine goodness, her purity. I realize purity or innocence has taken on some connotations, maybe negative connotations in our modern sense, but I don't think this is what was intended. I think it just means that she hasn't experienced evil. She has a childlike goodness about her because of that inexperience of evil. That's not a bad thing. That's actually, we're going to see a strength. But it does open the door to weakness in her naivete. Hence, this is something that she herself has to learn, unfortunately, the hard way to overcome. But in her Snow White nature, this virtue, this goodness, is a threat to the queen, but everyone else is totally taken aback by it. It just allows them to drop their guard that's normally up. They know they can trust her, and they're attracted to her because they know they can trust her. Every other character in the story responds to her this way. That is a real strength that she has. So Walt Disney's doing something with her character. There's a depth here, just like with the Wicked Queen. There's a depth here. What makes her wicked? And we see that it's her vanity, her imbalance, her lust for power, her superficiality, her unwillingness to trust goodness, her unwillingness to love. As she's sheltered up in her own life, like she is when she goes down into her dungeon, we see that being played out. But then with Snow White, we're seeing a strength here. In every scene she appears, she's the central figure. The action revolves around her, not in a self-centered way, not like the queen, but rather in a way that everybody wants to be with her. They're attracted to her. The animals, the forest creatures, the dwarves, the prince, who encounters her right at the beginning when she's scrubbing, so he doesn't know who she is. She's wearing rags because the wicked stepmother is forcing her into labor because she wants to hide her beauty. She wants to hide her true nature as a royal daughter of the king, destined for something greater. She's trying to use her power and her manipulation to keep Snow White down. That's when, in her singing, revealing her harmony, her beauty, her willingness to sustain her goodness in nature that is struggling to receive it, and she's struggling to understand it. This is part of the tension. That's when the prince comes in. And then he joins in the song, and you see that there's a true harmony going on with the singing between each other. But she flees because she doesn't know what to make of it. From that point forward, all we know about the prince is, beside his bit part, he just appears here and there, is he's after her in a good way. He is drawn to her. She draws him out of himself, calls him forth from his lower to his higher self so that he's willing to sacrifice. Indeed, this is the leadership that we see from her in every scene. As she wins over with her joyful spirit, as she brings order out of chaos, like when she cleans a little cottage that she finds in the woods when she's fleeing from the wicked queen, she is able to draw sacrificial love from all she encounters, from the animals, the prince, and even the dwarves. So this is not a weakness. This is not a damsel in distress, incapable of helping herself. This is a person who has great power she's unaware of yet. Because she hasn't encountered the challenges of evil, she doesn't know what she's capable of doing. But the capability, the capacity is revealed as she encounters these seven dwarves in this peaceful cottage that's tucked away and hidden away. Again, a sign that this kind of goodness and this kind of feminine power, while it's being discovered, has to be protected, kind of like putting a plant in a greenhouse. So this cottage has to be protected deep in the woods where she can't be discovered and destroyed. Indeed, this is where the dwarves live for the same reason. We'll get to them in a moment because we see that they too are very innocent. And it's within this cottage that she draws the forest creatures who are normally preyed upon by the bears and the foxes and the wolves. But with her, the sense of trust draws them out, first out of curiosity, then they too are attracted to her. And so it is in every scene she appears. Her harmony creates harmony in her surroundings. It draws out the goodness of others. It draws out their desire to sacrifice. It draws out their love. So it draws out these powers that otherwise remain hidden in a dark and lonely and terrible world, the world in which the queen wants to thrive in and wants to make her own as her domain. And yet these powers, we shall see, are more powerful than that dark, evil world. But you have to discover it, and it can only be discovered through the challenge. So this is Snow White. I don't think she's weak for these reasons. Her spirit is so joyful. She overcomes her fear through the friendship with these creatures. She then draws the dwarves to her side. And her goal in life, once she meets Grumpy, is to win Grumpy over, which she eventually does, so that he's not so grumpy. Because he is the cynical one, Mr. Suspicion himself. The dwarves are suspicious, but as they get to know her, they can't help but love her. And of course, Dopey is the one who shows the dwarvish or the masculine innocence, albeit more in a childish way. He's not very intelligent. He's not very coordinated, but he's lovable because of his own innocence, his own goodness that shines out. And of course, there's a special bond between those two. He tricks her and gets a kiss from her twice, in fact. All right, so let's turn our attention to the dwarves. I've been talking about them. So I want us to see this contrast of femininity between Snow White and the Wicked Queen, and the lack of love and her desire for power, and Snow White's goodness, but some naivete in there because she doesn't know how to handle evil yet. The dwarves, they too sing, and their job is they mine jewels all day. In fact, their mine is a gold mine of jewels, no pun intended. When you look at it, the walls are just constantly shimmering, all the gems that they find there. And yet, these seven little men, indicating their humility, are not corrupted by this wealth. I don't know who they sell it to or where it goes to. You'd think they'd have a fortune at their cottage in the woods. It'd be more like a mansion in the woods. But they seem very content with leading very simple lives, despite their access to this wealthy business that they're involved in, these jewels that they're mining all day. And they sing while they work, showing that for them, work is joyful. It's something that helps them discover their own fulfillment as I was going to call them humans, but as humanoid creatures. They're human-like, even though they're dwarves. We see their friendships, we see their annoyances with each other, and it provides some comic relief, some humor. The humor is a very important part of Walt Disney stories too, because it shows that there is a levity, a laughable nature to the world in which he's inviting us into. So that even though this is an animated movie, and we recognize immediately we're not seeing reality. Of course, we do that in any movie we go to. Even more so with this one, it's clearly animated. We buy into it because we see immediately how something real is reflected in it. not just the colors and the three dimensions and the expressions that I mentioned earlier, but there's the sophistication, this wisdom that's being portrayed that tells us something about ourselves and the world in which we live. And so these dwarves, they represent an innocence for men because they're able to work joyfully, not for the man, not with some kind of resentment, and they're not corrupted by their wealth. But they have access to it. They're loading these jewels into their wheelbarrows, and in our age, you look at it, they'd be multi-millionaires if they had access to those kind of jewels. This is not their interest. So what is their interest? Their interest is just to live simply, and they're happy doing so. They value that. They value each other's friendship. There's no other women in their lives, and they seem content with that. And I realize we're so shocked with that with our own modern era, but if you've ever been to, say, a monastery that's well run, you find something similar. Men who live without women, who work, and who are happy and who aren't corrupted by their surroundings. I happen to be friends with some monks, so I know this to be the case. All right, so this is kind of a monastic existence from these guys. They come home and they find her. And she figures out their names because it's written on their beds, in case they're so fatigued, they forget whose bed is whose. And the self-discovery becomes exciting as they find out who she is and she finds out who they are. And of course, Grumpy's the one who's the cynic, who's suspicious, and who's giving his words of warning to the men. But slowly he gets won over by her. You know, in this scene with her in the cottage, this scene takes a lot of the movie. There's not a lot of action. They eat dinner, or she prepares it, but she forces them all to wash. Again, more comic relief, bringing order out of chaos because they're all filthy. She's already cleaned the place. She's preparing the meal. Don't know where they get their food from. And she prepares enough for everybody. And then they sing afterwards, and they dance, and they have a joyful time, a time of laughter, of frivolity, a time of friendship. And this is a unique feature of a lot of Walt Disney movies, because he wants to emphasize the relationships, how the relationships themselves, when they are based on true friendship and love, explode, if you will, into this joyful singing and dancing. There's always this frivolous nature that you find in his movies when these friendships really get going. This makes a good middle portion of the movie. There's no other action than that. But again, he's showing how she brings harmony out of this, brings strength to the relationships, and because of the trust, they're able to laugh and dance and sing and be foolish together without embarrassment. A strength, as I said, that she has. And they're all focused on her. Okay, so these are the dwarves, and I find them interesting. There is a hierarchy within them, that Doc is the leader, Dopey's kind of the least, but they all see Snow White as the top of the hierarchy because they wish to serve her, as do the animals, as does the prince. So everyone in the movie wants to serve her, wants to sacrifice for her, except the queen, who's so jealous and envious of her, she wants to destroy her. And so the tension builds as Snow White wins over more and more people, and we see that kind of power revealed, a power she doesn't know she has, a power she's not seeking to cultivate, a power that's not threatening, except to the queen. So as this is shown itself, the movie cuts back to her as she discovers Snow White is still alive, and now she has to take her destruction into her own hands. It's up to her now to go destroy Snow White, because she cannot stand the fact that she lives in this world with the queen. The queen's own wickedness necessarily wants to destroy the feminine genius, the feminine goodness of Snow White. Isn't this interesting? Rather than can't beat them, join them, she sees it as her task to destroy her. So how does she do it? Well, she wants to create a disguise for herself, a disguise that's based on elements that already exist, from a scream to the dark of night, to the wind and rain, the lightning, and other things that she takes from other elements that are already pre-existing, and she just mixes them into some potion to hide her her nature as the Wicked Queen. But the irony here is it actually reveals who she really is, this ugly, hideous, jealous, murderous old woman who's lonely, who has no relationships. Her dungeon is filled with bats and spiders and rats, none of whom really want to be with her, and bones of dead people. So she hangs out in darkness and death. That's her world. That's her power. That's what she wants. So she goes down there, she creates this potion in her dungeon, in her castle, disguises her, which actually reveals her, and then creates the poison apple. So Judeo-Christians recognize the temptation with the poison fruit being replayed here, albeit differently. But we see the forces of the enemy and her envy, her jealousy, her murderous ways, her vanity, her superficiality, and her thirst and her lust for power. That's all present. And this is what drives her to want to attack Snow White. These evil deeds of hers, where she disguises herself and creates this poisoned apple, reveal. This is why the fruit reveal the rotten tree that she is, and why the rats scurry, and then the cackle that she has. The actress, the voice actress, whoever it is that portrayed her, is really fantastic, because that's probably the best cackle I've ever heard any actress perform. And then the Wicked Queen, disguised as this old woman, heads out into the forest because she knows that Snow White is in some cottagers hidden somewhere. And with her necromancy, her ability to figure things out, she discovers her. The minute she shows up with her poisoned apple, the animals recognize her. These animals of prey, these innocent forest creatures, what do? They immediately seek to protect Snow White, but their inability to do so actually exposes Snow White, because the queen is able to draw pity out of Snow White, who invites her in. Come on, Snow White, what do you think you're doing? And here we see the weakness of her ignorance of evil, which is not bad in and of itself. It's the naivete that's tied with it. She trusts the wrong things because she hasn't learned, or she's unwilling to learn otherwise. The animals, in the best way they know how, are trying to warn her. That's why they're fluttering and squeaking, and the deer's trying to shove the old woman away, and they're trying to warn Snow White in the best way they know how, but they speak animal talk, and Snow White speaks human talk, and they can't communicate. And so Snow White misunderstands, or at least ignores, and chooses to reject the warnings the animals are giving her, and invites the queen in. The animals can only do one thing now, that is go to the dwarves and warn them, and that's successful. The dwarves figure it out. And who figures out? It's Sleepy, the one who's least aware, least conscious of his surroundings, but he's the one who's able to recognize what's going on, because he's not distracted by work, by singing, by the others. And so that gives him some clarity of thought. Maybe the Wicked Queen is coming for her. And that arouses Doc, who arouses the rest of the men, to hurry back to the cottage to rescue Snow White. Because they know the nature of the Queen more than Snow White. That's why they're tucked away in the cottage. They know the nature of the world. So it doesn't take much to get them riled and rallied, to grab their pickaxes and their shovels and head back on the backs of deer and whatever else they can get onto, to hurry with speed back to the cottage. Meanwhile, the Wicked Queen is using some other weakness of Snow White, if you will, the yearning she has in her heart for the prince. Now again, this isn't bad. It's not bad to yearn for the love of another, to want to be cherished, to have someone who's going to serve and sacrifice for you. We all want that. None of us want friends who are two-faced. Nobody wants to be used. Nobody wants to be stabbed in the back. We don't want someone who is our friend when we're around and talks bad about us when we're not. We want the person who's legitimate, who values us, and who isn't going to do that. And we hope in our friendship and in our relationships, we draw that out of our friends as we try to cultivate it in ourselves. This is the strength of Snow White, but she doesn't get how there can still be people in this world who, despite all of that, will choose their own selfishness and will follow their own vices, even to the point of destruction. And now we're getting to the point of irony. So we see the paradox of femininity, of Snow White's strength and weakness, how her strength can be a weakness, her weakness can be a strength, and she's not just this weak character who needs a man. On the contrary, her femininity draws the best out of people who desire to sacrifice, and this is the kind of relationships we want and she wants and that the prince wants, and that's what creates the harmony. And then we again see this wicked queen who turns inward. By the way, the word wickedness comes from an old Anglo-Saxon word where we get the word wicker, like a wicker basket, like where you bend the reeds to form the basket. It means to bend. This is one of the deeper meanings of this word, to bend. So we see how the queen wants to bend reality to match what she wants. And that's why she's using magic and potions to get it. She thinks she can take elements of reality and bend it according to her will, impose her will, and destroy because of it. She sees power as a destructive force that is what she wants, and that's what she wants to harness. She's not afraid of that. She doesn't trust goodness, which she should trust. She does trust destructive power, which she shouldn't trust. That's the queen, and that's her problem, and we'll see what happens when the two collide. All right, so you're excited now? Are you on the edge of your seat? She shows up. She gets the weakness of Snow White, which is for the prince. Her heart yearns for him, for this relational community, this friendship, this romance to take place, and that's how she gets her to eat the forbidden fruit. She takes advantage of her her naivete, her willingness to dialogue with evil, and her desire to have what she wants, but to do it in a way that maybe lacks patience. So this isn't a huge flaw of Snow White, but she doesn't have the patience or the trust in her own power, her own goodness, that will lead her to what she wants if only she waits and discovers herself. Instead, she buys the temptation to have a shortcut, something for nothing or a lot for a little. All she has to do is eat the apple and she'll discover the way to get the man of her dreams. Her wishes will come true. This man will be hers. This is the promise. It's done through a wish, through a shortcut, not through the normal means, and that's her downfall. And so she bites of the apple and she collapses. And the wicked witch cackles. The lightning, the wind, the darkness, the flashing of the lightning all happens right then. All the powers that she thought she could summon to hide herself that now actually reveal herself, that she could use to create this poison apple. It all comes to the fore right when the dwarves show up with the animals. And she sees them and she realizes there's a lot of them and only one of her. She doesn't have the power to withstand them yet, so she flees. But in fleeing, she goes up higher and higher on a mountain. The setting gets darker and darker, again to show the foreboding, the apparent victory of evil, the apparent victory of evil. And as she gets up to the top, as the dwarves are chasing after her, she takes a big stick, a log, and she tries to dislodge a boulder so that it'll come down and tumble down and squash the dwarves, and her victory will be complete. Only, here's the poetic irony. The very forces she thought she could harness, the wind, the darkness, the lightning, etc., attacks her, destroys her. Because right then, right when she's about to dislodge that rock, a lightning bolt hits and destroys the ledge upon which she is sitting, and she screams as she falls over a cliff to her own doom. And the two vultures, who are supposed to be her pet, now they swoop after her to feast on her carcass, and she destroys herself. Oh, the poetic irony. The forces she thought she could handle end up destroying her, but what of Snow White? Well, the dwarves don't have the heart to bury her. They put her in a glass coffin. Well, that's interesting, because the glass coffin serves a role in the movie. It shows that Snow White, despite her naivete, is preserved from the full effect of the poisoned apple. She doesn't rot. She doesn't decay. She remains preserved. And then the story of this preserved princess encased in glass gets spread, and the prince is able to find out where she's hiding. And so they discover that there is an antidote to the poison after all. It is love's first kiss. So the prince lifts the glass lid, kisses Snow White, and she comes back to life. This kiss of love, love's first kiss, is the antidote that the wicked queen discovers but laughs off, because her love for power gets her to overlook the power of love. Okay, that's cliche, but it works, right? She loves power and she overlooks the power of love. She doesn't believe in it enough to think that it'll actually save Snow White when it does. But we find out something else about Snow White and the prince and the dwarves. When Snow White leaves them and goes off to be with her prince, she's no longer ready to live in this world. This world can no longer fully receive her. She's had sort of a resurrected experience by coming back from the dead. Now she's ready for some new domain, some heavenly realm. The castle, if you notice, the castle's not on earth. As she's going off with her prince to the castle, it's in the heavens, it's in the clouds, it's the sun itself, shimmering bright, showing the victory, this final victory of love, of goodness, the true feminine power that is Snow White's, once it's discovered, is now ready for its rightful place. A rightful place that may not be on this earth, although it can live on this earth for a time, to bring out the goodness, the genius of the others that encounter her, but without envy, without selfishness, without a desire to bend reality according to their own wishes and impose their own will on reality, but accepts it as its own terms, then they too are ready for this heavenly realm. And that's how the movie ends. Oh, it's a great movie. It's exciting. This is a more sophisticated presentation that people gave Walt credit for. He's really showing us some insights about virtue and vice and how the two work, and love and power. And all this is found in the Judeo-Christian tradition and the traditions of lots of world religions. It's found in the wisdom tradition of the ancient Greeks and other cultures. In fact, this provides the basis of any healthy culture, but it is easily lost. So the question becomes, is goodness fragile? Because it appears to be, here's one of the other ironies, whereas wickedness appears to be strong and durable, but in the end we see the reverse is true. It is wickedness that is so fragile. The wicked queen knows this. This is why she's so threatened by Snow White and has to destroy her. Meanwhile, we see that Snow White gets what she wants after all. Her wish comes true. She takes the poison, but love is able to dispel it. And she gets the prince, gets the castle, gets the happily ever after ending. That really is something that we yearn for, all of us. It's written into us. And so it's written into the story. It's written to any good story. And that's not being naive. That's recognizing what is fragile and what is strong. Goodness is stronger than evil. Evil is more fragile. Evil has apparent victories, but they're short-lived. And the means by which the victory seems to be achieved ends up turning on the evil person themselves. This we can see over and over again in life, in the world. I've had it happen in my own life, and this is the moral of the story. So I hope you enjoyed this retelling of this wonderful gem of an animated feature. I hope you go watch it again. It's something you can watch again and again with your children, your grandchildren, and whomever. And maybe you too will pick up some insights, I'm sure you will, that I won't pick up and notice because I'm not you. And you can share those with me. All right. Well, until next time, God bless you and thank you.